Hello, bold Americans. How are you? Do you remember Saturday morning cartoons used to sneak downstairs 7 o'clock, 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, somewhere around there? Your parents would still be asleep. You'd start the cartoons or Captain Kangaroo up and you'd watch straight through until 11 a.m. or 12 p.m. maybe. During that time, there was one show that really grabbed my attention. It was called Voltron. And Voltron relied on the power of each of the characters to combine at the end in order to fight evil. Well, today, that's what this show is going to do. I have paired up for my conversation with an absolute giant here. We have Mr. Paul Engel from the Constitution Study on America Out Loud. He's here with me today. So sit back, grab yourself a cup of coffee or whatever else it is that you are into and enjoy, because you're listening to America Emboldened with Greg Bolden on the America Out Loud Network. All right, bold Americans, I have a special guest for you today. It is Mr. Paul Engel, the Constitution Study himself, as heard on the America Out Loud Network, as well as his website, constitutionstudy.com. So Paul is going to be here with us today because I wanted to unpack my interview with Michael Bednarik, as well as talk about the constitutional crisis our country finds ourselves in today. So Paul, thank you for joining me. How are you today?
Oh, you're welcome. I'm having a good day.
Excellent. That's what I like to hear. So, Paul, let's start off with Michael Bednarik. He had studied the Constitution and taught it for about 30 years. Mm-hmm. For those that don't know, he released a statement yesterday on his website that just acknowledged the people. He is dying. My interview with him was likely the final interview that he'll ever do. So I wanted to encapsulate those words for the American public. But he paints a very grim picture that states that we are beyond the point of fixing our country, that the Constitution is basically over, it's been trampled on, and we're straight into communism and there's no turning back. As somebody who's also dedicated their life to studying the Constitution, I wanted a response from somebody else who's an expert to maybe balance what Michael stated for the listeners.
You know, I listened to both parts of the interview, and it was very interesting for me because the first two-thirds of the first part, very much on board. You know, I'm following him, agreeing with him. I'm like, it's a kindred spirit. Where do I get in touch with this man? But you made a point that he's been doing this for 30 years, and roughly the last third of the first part, into the second, you could hear in his voice the exhaustion, the frustration. And I can imagine 30 years of beating your head against the wall has got to hurt. I have not been doing it that long, so I'm not to the, you know, bloody forehead stage, but I agree. We are perilously close to having, only having two choices left. And that is fighting or surrendering when it comes to liberty. We are perilously close. And in fact, I just recorded a radio episode for for America Out Loud. And I was saying, we got here because the American people gave up. Not so much gave up. We decided that we didn't want to suffer the consequences of our decisions. And if you look at, I looked at stories from Portland, Oregon, and Minnesota, even into things like what's going on at the CDC, and just seeing how our actions as citizens, how we went about choosing our representatives in government, how we went about choosing those in the executive branch, how we vet them, has really led us to this place where nobody trusts, or very few people trust the American government. I think in one poll, they said something like, 49% believe America is so corrupt, the only answer is an armed conflict. We got there because we let this mess fester. And as someone who spent 30 years trying to show people, yeah, I could understand his frustration, especially now knowing that he's coming to the end of his time here on Earth and seeing the state that we are in compared to 30 years ago. I'd be pretty depressed too, to think I inherited the country of the 1980s And what I'm leaving is a country of the 2020s. That is not a legacy I would be proud of. But I don't think we have, you know, I still think there's a chance. And it's actually what I've been focusing on lately. I'm doing a tour this summer and fall, focusing on the idea that we can still enjoy the blessings of liberty. We can still spread those blessings. We've got to focus on the right things if we're going to do that. And the right thing is not putting all of our hope in the bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. It's learning to live as a free people and understanding that the Constitution says, yeah, you can do that. You don't need government's permission to exercise these rights. You have them. It's your job to defend them. Now, what do you do to help other people join you in defending them?
And it's not lost on me that people like Bernie Sanders is being elected, calling himself a socialist. Mm-hmm. And people have no problem voting for that. Matter of fact, we almost voted him for president in this country. There is a popular movement to have him the nominee for the Democratic Party. So I can understand where Michael's coming from. And I even tried to make a parallel when we talk about the violence that may need to happen. That is a very taboo topic to talk about, because when you start to have that conversation with anybody, it's uncomfortable. People start going, well, what side am I on? Am I on the wrong side or am I on the right side? And I think the line's pretty clear at this point as to who's on the proper side of the Constitution, who's against the Constitution. And when I look at something like January 6th, I am by no means defending violence or how people may have hurt officers or any of that. I'm not here to debate that. What I'm trying to point out to the American public, and I wanted to see if you agree with this, Michael kind of evaded the question. I stated that Black Lives Matter and the burning of the streets and January 6th, the insurrection, as the Democrats are calling it, to me, it's part of the fabric of finally uprising. We're starting to see the uprising of what happens when people get upset about how they perceive a government does not represent them. And that's not to be political about Black Lives Matter or be political about whatever people want to say about a far right, alt-right movement. All I'm trying to state is that I can understand that if you feel as a Black man, a Black woman, that your country is violating your amendment rights, the Constitution's not properly representing for you, I can understand burning a city. I can understand violence. I think it was misdirected. I don't think it was directed nearly properly enough. Just as I understand January 6th, if you really feel that our country is in shambles after COVID, our country has possibly had a election that is fraudulent, if you were led down that, I understand you go to the Capitol and you demand for change. Do you agree that we are seeing possibly the actual beginning of insurrection based upon a violation of constitutional rights?
I would say we are seeing an insurrection, but not necessarily based on on the question of constitutional rights. It is my firm opinion that if there is a second civil war, an actual hot civil war, it will not be started by those who are defending the Constitution. It'll be started by the progressives. And the reason is simple. Just think for yourself, the recent examples of violence, vandalism, assaults, murder, arson. When you think of organized groups that are doing this, tell me which one of those would be considered quote unquote conservative, and how many of them would be progressive? They're all progressive. Antifa, Black Lives Matters, those who, even going back farther, go back into the riots over the World Economic Forum meetings or any of these international meetings. You have a progressive group that believes violence is a proper response to their concerns. Now, what I find interesting is if you take the two groups, the question rarely focuses on the Constitution. In other words, the BLMs, the Antifas, they're not fighting because they think the Constitution's been violated. They're violating because they think their rights have been violated. I say think their rights, because most people assign the word right to anything they really, really want, as opposed to an actual dictionary definition of right. Now, you look at January 6th, and yeah, there were some knuckleheads. There were some knuckleheads that, you know, gee, maybe breaking into the Capitol is not a good idea. Right? There were those who said, you know, hey, what? I get invited in. The doors are opened by the police. I walk in. You know, somebody grabs something. That's not a smart idea. But the only death on January 6th was caused by Capitol Police. The only act, and in fact, the only act of violence I have heard confirmed was done by the U.S. Capitol Police. Now, that, like you said, that isn't, you know, if you broke the law, if you vandalized, if you stole, if you trespassed, but we need to punish the crimes, we need to punish the crimes that were actually committed, not the made up fantasies of, oh, they were disrupting, you know, governmental actions. We missed it. It's one of the reasons why this censorship movement, in my opinion, is so dangerous, because we are effectively allowing one philosophical idea to determine what things are and what things mean. You're only getting one side of the story. And if you're not allowed to hear the opposite side, then it's never questioned and you never actually come to what the truth is.
Yeah, you just unpacked a lot. I want to go back a few paragraphs there and what you were saying. When we talk about the progressives, right? Antifa, Black Lives Matter, these progressive movements. Here's the opposite argument that I want to pose to you. Some of those people would state that the founding fathers were originally progressives. They were progressives in wanting the change from Britain. How do you respond to an ideology, which I don't think that it's an ideology that's wise, but how do you respond to an ideology that compares their movement to what the founding fathers felt was moving the country in the right way, even though you and I would both argue that's not the right way?
Well, it's one of the reasons why I try to eschew labels, and I try to use the scare quotes as often as possible, because everybody has their own definition of what's a progressive, what's a conservative, what's a Republican, what's a Democrat. Here's what I find is the difference. We talk a lot about the progressive movement. We rarely ask what they are progressing to. See, progress implies movement, and I'm moving somewhere. Now, if I wanted to look at the founding fathers and say, what were they progressing to? They were progressing to a limited central government with a free people governing themselves, where their rights were protected, compared to today's progressive, which has a top-down governmental structure where we are all meant to be exactly the same and exactly uniform. And rather than deciding for ourselves how to live our life, we will be told how we can live our life, which is always interesting, because the progressives are actually progressing to a regressive state of liberty. Not, you know, they're progressing into slavery. And we've seen it before. This has happened over and over in history, but we never seem to learn that lesson.
Careful, Paul. You can't say they're going to slavery. You're going to offend somebody.
Well, think about it. You have, I offend people all the time. I'm sorry. I'm not sorry that I offend you. I'm sorry that your feelings may be hurt, but look at what the progressives stand for. They want everybody to have the same. They want the government to control your healthcare. They want the government to control your education. They want the government to control your workplace. They want the government. They want an elite few to control as many aspects of your life as absolutely possible. That is the antithesis of liberty. Liberty is the defined by Noah Webster in his 1828 dictionary. In general, it is living your life without external influence. That is the exact opposite of the progressives. Now, if you think about it, we have a history in this country of a people who had their healthcare decisions, their employment decisions, where they lived, how they lived, all decided for them. We called them slaves. We outlawed it in the 13th Amendment. But if you think about it, if you are dependent on someone else for every aspect of your life, You are enslaved to them. They can make you do whatever they want by simply cutting off your health care, telling you, oh, you can't work right now. You're not essential. You have to get a jab. You have to wear a mask. You have to go to this school, not that school. You're not allowed to hear about contradictory information. You are dependent on them for everything from safety to education. You are a slave. You just may not realize it.
That's beautifully put there, Paul. I couldn't have said any of that better myself, which is why you're my guest today on the show.
Thank you.
I hope that people are listening. Again, if you're hearing Paul's words right now, and this is resonating with you or it's challenging you, that is awesome. You can check him out every single day, Monday through Friday, on the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network, where he has a radio show, as well as constitutionstudy.com, where you can register for Constitution classes to hear more of the wisdom that's coming straight from Paul right now. Okay, so I think you've clearly defined the progressive movement in a way that I was actually hoping to hear more defined for myself. So thank you. If you did that for me, you did that for other people. The second part of going back to the insurrection that I want to clarify, I believe that we need to acknowledge certain parts because people get caught up in semantics, right? They like to argue, especially the progressives. They like to argue, but you forgot about this. And you are correct. The only person that actually died was by the Capitol Police when she crossed over by Pelosi. She was shot and killed. And I still don't think there's justice for her. But there were police officers who had heart attacks as a result of what happened that day on site. And one person, I believe, died from a heart attack. And we could make a case that if it was a peaceful day and that's not where they went to work, they weren't under stress, perhaps they'd still be alive. That stated, when we talk about insurrection, progressives like to come back to but it's really a bunch of ado about nothing when it comes to violence. It was a defacing of the Capitol. It was trespassing of the Capitol, unless you look at the fact that police officers opened the door and said, come on in. But we're not allowed to talk about that, apparently. And it's not making it into the video anymore, even though I watched it live online as it unfolded. We are in a really politicized environment of but. Look over here. Don't pay attention to the facts here, because I just have this small fact to justify everything else. Which leads me to, our country is in crisis and our Constitution's in crisis. Right now, I think you have probably the hardest podcast and hardest job to do to make sense of the Constitution, because we have Supreme Court justices that seem like the institution itself is failing the country. And it's not that those individuals have necessarily failed the country. It's that the presidents and the electorate, just as we stated, you know, Bernie Sanders being elected as a socialist, we are electing people in order to have our feelings of laws decided. Where I was under the impression the checks and balances and the way the Constitution was set up and our country was set up, Supreme Court was supposed to be strictly constitutional scholars that could interpret and state, here's what the Constitution meant. If we look through the historical perspective, and here's how the ruling goes. At what point did the institution, do you feel, begin to fail by the politicization of the court, where now we have people who clearly have agendas on both sides? I think it's fair to say there definitely is an agenda on both sides of the court.
You know, there's a lot there to unpack. understand, you say that I have a hard job. My job is really pretty simple. See, the difference is I study the Constitution. Right? Little thing, it's only 8,000 words. It is written in plain English. Now, here's the problem. I've asked lawyers for years, when you were in law school, did you study the Constitution or constitutional law? I've had one gentleman tell me in the last 4 or 5 years, they studied the Constitution. Judges, they don't teach the Constitution in law school, which means those 9 high priests in black robes are not dealing with the 8,000 words of the Constitution, but they're dealing with the millions and millions and millions of words of other judges' opinion. In other words, they take a very simple concept and they've made it very complicated. And I believe they do it for a couple of reasons. I can't read their minds, but my impression is one is there's this this rush that comes with being an expert, with proving you know more than everybody else, with taking something simple and making it complicated to show off who you are. There's a rush to that. I see it in not just in legal terms, but in other terms. You see it in a lot of the churches and liturgical movements. We see it in politics. We see it in a lot of society and social movements. The other reason is they found out that if you cannot get your way through the legislative process, you can have it imposed via the judicial process. This goes all the way back when John Adams lost the presidential election to Thomas Jefferson in 1800. He attempted to pack the federal courts. Court packing is nothing new. By the way, it is from this fact that we get the infamous case Marbury versus Madison that is so often misquoted and misrepresented nowadays, because we play a giant game of telephone. So, for example, the Constitution says your right to the Constitution that Congress shall make no law regarding the establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or press. Very simple language, right? Congress cannot make a law that abridges your freedom of speech or press. Yet the courts say, well, if it's a right protected by the Constitution, if government has a sufficiently compelling interest in doing so, yes, they can literally violate the words of the Constitution. That's what makes it complicated, because now instead of it being very simple, shall not no longer means shall not. It means shall not unless 5 of 9 justices on the Supreme Court think, well, you had a really good reason to do so. And this has led to, well, if I can get, you know, take somebody, like you said, spend 30 years trying to get something done and haven't been able to. You go back, and I'll pick on the infamous 73 case of Roe versus Wade. You had a group of people that tried to legalize abortion. And they couldn't, and they couldn't, and they couldn't. And finally, they got a court to say, hey, forget democracy. We're not a democracy, we're a republic. But forget the democratic process. Forget the representatives of the people. We will impose it by fiat. We will make it up and impose it by fiat. And while that was not the first example of what I would consider judicial malfeasance, it is probably one of the best known. And it certainly changed. It was in one of the inflection points in history where more and more you saw people that said, if I can't get my way via the legislative process, I'll get it by the judicial process, which means if you believe in abortion, if you believe in the progressive ideologies, you would do anything to prevent a justice that would challenge your assumption. So you look at the hearings where they're reviewing Supreme Court justices. You know what I never heard in any of these things? Explain to me the constitutional basis for this. They never do. It was like, well, do you support this? Is Roe v. Wade, quote, settled law? By the way, the legal answer is no, but the political answer is yes. You know, is precedent supreme? We have all of these things, and it turned it into it helped turn the court into a political game, because every justice knows from Bork on, every justice knows if you don't toe the line and give the political actors in the Senate the political answer they want, you're not getting the job. They basically extorted them into allowing support for Roe v. Wade as a requirement of getting the job. And the fact that now, 50 years later, a court has finally said, you know what? They were wrong back in 1973, and we are finally gonna fix that. Here you go. Actually gives me hope for the court. I trust me, I've said for years, if there are 9 people in this country that need a reading comprehension course, it is the justices of the Supreme Court. They literally cannot understand plain basic English, or they refuse to use that in their opinions. But between Dobbs and Bruin and EPA, we saw 3 court cases where the court put the actual language of the law superior to precedent and to political preferences. And what I find interesting is just after this term, Justice Kagan was speaking at a conference in Minnesota, and she warned, she says, listen, if the members of the court don't start paying attention to popular opinion, the court will lose legitimacy. Her opinion is that the court is not a court of law. It is another legislature. And that shows that where the court had gone. The fact that now we've got Kavanaugh and Gorsuch and Barrett, now we're starting to see the court saying, maybe we can actually apply the law rather than becoming the law.
Paul, I want to continue with this conversation and talk a little bit about Chief Justice Roberts in just a moment. First, if you're enjoying this conversation, go to Twitter, follow @RealGregBolden. Feel free to share the post out, spread the word about this podcast, or you can email me with any thoughts, greg@americaembolden.com. We're going to take a quick pause here for a break from our sponsors, and we will be right back.
As Americans, we seek to form a more perfect union. To paraphrase Abraham Lincoln, we are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And God willing, we shall not perish from the earth. AmericaOutloud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support, delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
All right, you've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the povidone iodine-based nasal spray Cofix RX. They talk about it because it's a product that actually works in combating colds, flus, and coronaviruses. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. It's simple. By attacking viruses where they incubate, you make it easier for your body to heal. Check out the Cofix RX banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and save 20% by using promo code OUTLOUD.
I find it concerning that the story that just came out about how Chief Justice John Roberts was basically lobbying the other conservative judges to try to save abortion rights. I would rather not see lobbying in my Supreme Court. I would rather see them just make a decision, and they can dissent against one another. They can agree with one another, but there's no lobbying. I don't believe lobbying has any place in our court system. I believe they should have to make their arguments. How do you feel about lobbying when it comes to what's going to be the law of the land?
You know, you could call it lobbying. You could call it debating. The idea is you have now nine people that are trying to come to a decision, and you have nine different points of view. And, you know, there's a scripture verse in Proverbs where it says, as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens his countenance against another. The idea, it's that conflict. It's that, but I say this and you say this, that helps us actually grind down to the truth. Now, the fact that the justices discuss, attempt to persuade, call it lobbying or call it debating, you know, here's my point of view, and this is why I think you should do this, is it's part of a collaborative process. What, and the fact that Roberts was trying to, was lobbying to protect Roe does not surprise you one little bit. You have to remember, this is the only justice I know that authored both the opinion and the dissent in the same case. In this case, NFIB versus Sebelius at the Affordable Care Act. Roberts has been a squish since the day he was appointed. He is worried about what the court looks like, not what the court actually does.
And it seems to me that voters at this point, the progressive voters in this country, want to elect officials that are going to further that agenda of making sure that the court is a court of public opinion rather than a court of interpretation of a document. And that to me is a scary place to be in. So you would agree then that that's definitely a constitutional crisis point for our country?
The fact that progressives want this is not the constitutional. The problem is that we have hired 9 justices, many of whom believe the Constitution doesn't mean what it says. And I forget which one.
Paul, isn't that the actual institution failing then?
Is it the institution failing, or is it the people in the institution that is failing?
I think it doesn't matter one way or the other. If the people that we put in are failing, the institution itself is failing. The Supreme Court cannot stand.
But we've just seen it start to turn a corner, right? Haven't we?
We have, we're turning a corner with, you know, President Biden and Kamala Harris in the wings, even scarier, Nancy Pelosi, even more frightening, wanting to pack the courts and wanting to use the court of public opinion to do so. I believe that we are in a very scary precipice in our country when it comes to the Supreme Court.
Oh, I agree. So for me, the issue is not the fact that progressives want to influence the court. Conservatives want to influence the court as well. When the progressives say, if we don't get our way, we're going to act like a 4-year-old in the grocery store that didn't get the cereal they want. They're going to throw a temper tantrum. They're going to be violent. They're going to do what they need to do to get their answer. That it will be what destroys a court, not disagreements among the court. One of the things I found interesting, I think it was in the Bruin case, and I believe it was Elena Kagan who wrote in the dissent, you know, why in heaven's, paraphrasing, well, it was wrong for the majority of the court to actually interpret the 14th Amendment based on the understanding of the words by the people who actually drafted the 14th Amendment and ratified the 14th Amendment. Why would you not change it over time? That's this living constitution idea, which, you know, is promoted a lot as a way to get around the actual language of the Constitution. It works nowhere else. There's no other place in contract law. There's no other place in institutional law regarding international agreements where the understanding of the words is anything but the people who actually ratified it. If you want to change it, change it. Don't simply say, well, you know, 2 + 2 = 5 today because we want it to equal 5. Sex equals gender because we want it to. That's not legislating. That's not even litigating. That is simple. That's totalitarianism. That is 1984. You know, we're just going to make the words mean different things because that's how we maintain control over people.
Yeah, I just listened to your podcast on that yesterday, and it was excellent, by the way. If you want to get into the podcast that you did on the words and the language that we use, highly recommend you go back and check out Paul's words there. I also addressed it with my disinformation. Who controls the language controls the power is basically where I was going with that.
Which, by the way, is why you see the progressives are so afraid of the other side getting a voice. They will do anything they can to prevent counter information because I firmly agree they realize when their words and their positions are shown in the light of day, they crumble like a vampire, just crumble to dust.
Well, you know, I'm getting lots of feedback on the podcast since I joined the network. And the overwhelming part that I find, I laugh about it. It's hilarious. It's the people that criticize me for taking a side not realizing that my podcast, the mere reason it exists is because I am trying to use philosophy to figure out how do we converse between two opposing views. I'm a libertarian. You know, if we got into when people ask me, well, how do you feel about gay marriage? My first response is, why the hell does government need to be in marriage? It doesn't make my marriage any more valid. I don't think that they should be involved whatsoever. They don't legitimize my marriage with my wife, and they shouldn't legitimize your marriage with your husband. Like, just get government out of your life, you know, there. Like, let people make their personal decisions and live with those decisions. I think that's really important. But when I have these conversations, and the reason why I wanted to have this with you and for anybody I speak with, it's to try to figure out, is there a way that if a progressive says we're not willing to give a voice there, we could find a way, how could we phrase this to just give me a moment to listen? And I'm hopeful that my podcast does that. I'm hopeful that people will at least give it a listen. They may not agree with what they state, but it disarms the, you don't have a voice. And it's a shame that, you know, we have other people on this network, you know, like Dr. Peter McCullough. If you just look directly at him, one of the most brilliant doctors in the country, who has a different narrative on the COVID vaccine, and most of the news networks won't touch him, despite the fact that he's one of the leading people in the entire country, because it doesn't go with what one side wants to share. And so when we start censoring this, then I can start to understand, yeah, Michael Bednarik in that interview with him is correct. We are living in a communist country. We are living in a spot where only one side controls most of the information. The rest of us are pushed off the podcast and called crazy. It brings me to the Second Amendment, and it brings me to the start of our conversation. Let's come back, circle back around. If we're left with just giving in, bending over, we're not going to take it, you know, or just laying down, we're just going to let it happen, roll over us, versus there's going to be some type of civil war, some type of violence, it makes sense to me that people are at this point looking at the Second Amendment and trying to strip away Second Amendment rights. Do you believe that there's other smart people like ourselves that are out there having these conversations about, well, gee, our country is at a crossroads, it could get violent? Do you think that there's anything to that? Maybe that's their agenda, to take away the Second Amendment?
Oh, absolutely. And I believe the evidence, not what people say, but what people do, is clear. And the perfect example, to me, the perfect example of that is, before the bodies are cold, there are gun control laws being proposed. They're called gun control laws. They don't control guns, they control people. And they almost always involve punishing innocent, law-abiding citizens for the crimes of the bad actors. But, you know, you asked a very important question about what do we do? How do we communicate when one side is controlling the narrative? And there's a couple things I've learned over the years. One is, we think, we react, we respond as human beings to stories. Facts and figures rarely turn a discussion or debate. But simple stories, especially that can be applied to the individual, make a tremendous difference. The example I saw, I saw a video of this. There was some debate about private property and you know, collecting taxes and whatnot. And one gentleman was standing up and saying, you know, well, you know, we have to protect private property. And of course, his opponent got up and said, no, you know, it's a myth, we need to be socialist. Well, while he's sitting there listening to her rant on, he simply reached over, grabbed her pocketbook, and started rifling through it. Right in front of her. I mean, he didn't hide it. He wasn't being sneaky. He just reached over and he started looking through it. And she said, well, what are you doing? I said, I'm looking through your pocketbook. Well, that's mine. No, you said there is no private property. There's nothing private about this. That may not have impacted the person he was debating, but it impacted people that were watching. And that to me is when I'm trying to teach, what I'm often trying to do is find a story, find an analogy to make it personally meaningful to you. Regardless of what I'm talking to, an individual or to a group. So when we start talking about things like the Second Amendment and, you know, is it an assault weapon? Is it the magazine ban? Is it red flag laws? It always boils down to, if, do you want to be dependent or not? Because the Second Amendment says that a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. Noah Webster defined a militia as an armed populace. And in fact, U.S. law defines the militia as an armed populace. Okay. So and if that's necessary to be...
Let me clarify too, because one of the things that, you know, the liberal progressive left loves to put up Ruth Ann Bader Ginsburg as the know-it-all. And even she stated, when it came to the militia, that the reason why they worded it that way is they never intended for the government, and correct me if I'm wrong, they never intended for the government to fund the defense of the country, that they wanted the states to be able to allow citizens to arm themselves should there be another war, should there be another bad actor, another tyrannical government that tries to come and throw us away from the United States back to a different type of system. So even, you know, Ruth Ann Bader Ginsburg stated that, yes, the militia is not, you got to go down to the corner and join this group that gets together on weekends and shoots. A militia was simply the state was giving rights for you to be armed. So that way every state, every citizen took it upon themselves to defend their country. Am I wrong on that? Or am I interpreting those words correct?
There's a couple of tweaks. Yes, our founding fathers did not want a standing army. They had seen what a standing army could do. Now, if you don't have a standing army, you still have to have a way to defend yourself. So you're right. The militias, and if you read the Constitution, the militias were ordinary citizens, armed citizens. They had officers that were chosen by the state legislatures. Even when they were called into service to the nation, they were their officer corps was chosen, trained, and maintained by the state so that the state would have security. But the second half where it says the right of the people will keep and bear arms shall not be infringed does not give anybody anything. You do not have an unalienable right because the government says gave it to you. It said the government cannot take away your right to keep and bear arms. And to the, I'll never forget one day sitting down to lunch with someone and we were discussing things and he said, well, you don't have a right to carry a firearm. I go, what do you think the word bear means? Is it an animal that poops in the woods? It's this idea that if you read the Second Amendment, it's structured in a very interesting way. So that first half, why do we have it? Because we need a well-regulated militia for the states to be secure. Secure from whom? They're not worried about Bambi and Thumper taking over the state. They were worried about the federal government and foreign governments coming in and taking over the state. So we needed an armed populace to be able to defend ourselves. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Nowhere in the Constitution does the people mean anything other than an individual right. Obviously, keep and bear, English language, I can own it, I can carry it. Arms is defined, again, by Noah Webster as weapons for offense and armor for defense. There's nothing in there that says, oh, well, that's a weapon of war, therefore the people can't have it. It does not say that. It says that your right to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It shall not be minimized, constrained, or controlled. Article 6, Clause 2 says that is the supreme law of the land. That language supersedes state law, federal law, judges' opinions. That is the supreme law of the land. It's when we begin to, the people begin to understand that just because Congress passed a law, just because a state legislature passed a law, doesn't mean it's legitimate, doesn't mean it's even legal. And when we begin to understand that government is there to work for us, not the other way around, then we begin to realize we can actually control this monstrosity that we've created, but it's going to take time, it's going to take effort, and it's going to take work. But if you go back to so many of the readings, words of our founding fathers, the Second Amendment is there for one purpose and one purpose only. is to prevent government from implementing illegal, unconstitutional, and unjust laws. I forget who was it said it that, you know, they will never be able to enforce an unjust law because the people armed will be able to prevent it. That's why we have a Second Amendment.
I think that's great. However, I know my show, I know your show probably, I don't want to speak for you, but I'm pretty sure neither of us want to be the one that causes the violence. Neither of us want to be the one that says, hey, you know what? Government's gotten too big. Hey, you know what? Progressives are taking us towards communism and it's the time to make a decision. Are we going to be comfortable with this and that's where we're at? Or are we going to have an uprising, which is going to end up being violent? That's the only way that can go. I know my show, I don't want to do that. I don't want to call for that. I'm not comfortable being the shot heard around the world. I don't believe that you are either. What will it take for this to be decided? Because the more I thought about it with what Michael Benarek said to me, and the more I sit here listening to your words about how the Second Amendment was for the tyrannical government, basically both federal and foreign, the more I think we're going to die. Like, it's not violently, we're going to die and just we'll become communists and the country won't be the country that it is. Am I wrong? I mean, to me, I think the government would just squash anybody that calls for anything else.
So let me throw a couple stories at you. One of my favorites actually comes, you mentioned the shot heard around the world. It comes from the Battle of Lexington. I've actually been to Lexington Green. And I remember the story when the British marched on Lexington Green and they were met by the Massachusetts militia. That militia was commanded by a then Captain John Parker. The British commander ordered the militia to lay down their arms and disperse. Now, you have to remember, the British Army was there for two purposes. One, they were looking for Adams and Jefferson, but their main primary mission was to confiscate the gunpowder, was to take the powder house and confiscate. It was gun control. They were marching to enforce gun control on the colonists. They show up at Lexington Green. They order the militia to lay down their arms. Captain John Parker said, I love this phrase. I wrote a book on this phrase. Stand your ground. Don't fire unless fired upon. But if they mean to have war, let it begin here. And I've always looked at it from that standpoint. The question is, when it comes to my rights, when it comes to how I live and how my family lives, I must decide where I will stand my ground. What is the quote unquote line in the sand that I will stand for? I believe we all, if we want to live free, must find that spot where we will stand our ground and not fall back, that we will not fire unless fired upon. We will not initiate violence. I agree. But we need to be prepared should violence be brought to us. But the line that always gets me is, but if they mean to have war. Now, I don't know about you. I have a daughter. She's 23 years old. She is inheriting a country that is not nearly as free as the one I inherited when I was her age. I have to ask myself, if the people who want to strip me of my rights, my family of my rights, my child of my rights, if they want to go to war over it, would I rather fight it or would I rather her fight it? And it is my personal opinion that if they mean to have war, I would rather fight it than have her fight it. But when you look at this, there's another point that, I wanted to say this before, and I want to bring it back around. See, we tend to think of this country as a monolith, right? Everything's the same. Everything is that's not the case. See, the problem is we are a federalist group. We are made up of states. Those states are made up of counties. Those counties are made up of people. And as I've traveled this country, I find that even in deep, deep, deep blue states, there are people who just want to live free. There are people who think like you do and like I do. So the what I see is the fall of the nation is not the breaking up so much as the attempt to homogenize everything. The attempt to make, you know, I heard one person describe Pennsylvania as you got Pittsburgh on one side, Philadelphia on the other side, and Alabama in the middle. Well, if you think about it, right, if if you look at the state, yeah, the rural areas, they're very much they look much more like Alabama in their philosophies. What I think happens is, even if there's an attempt to impose uniformity, there will always be areas that simply refuse to comply. And everyone says, well, the government will simply crush. There's a reason why we have that Second Amendment. There's a reason why our founding fathers thought it was so important that the people be armed. And I did a little bit of research. The federal government can put about 2 million people under arms between the regular military, the guard, the reserves. They got about 2 million armed people. That's a pretty good size army. There are over 100 million armed Americans. There are over 400 million guns they have. Now, if you do just a little bit of math, that is a 50-to-1 advantage in personnel if everybody does it. Look, we know that's not going to happen. When we fought the Revolutionary War, approximately 3% of the colonists actually fought in the war. So if you take those numbers, you take the 100 million gun owners and say only 3% of them are willing to fight, that's 3 million armed troops to 2 million armed troops. Assuming the 2 million armed troops will all fight for the government, because, well, many of them may actually believe in liberty and freedom for all, the government doesn't actually have the ability to impose its will either on the states or on the people without help. It's one of the reasons why I say, you know, too often we're distracted by what's going on in Washington, D.C. It's the magician's trick. Look at Fauci, look at Biden, look at this, look at that, while we watch our rights being stripped out from under us right here at home. It's one of the reasons why I tell my listeners, you start at the local level with your county and your city government. When your county and your city is protecting you and your rights, then you are free to either help others or to expand or to engage at the state and the federal level. And I am blessed to live in a county. I moved to Middle Tennessee seven years ago. And I have a sheriff who is very constitutionally minded. I've actually sat down and met with him on multiple occasions so that my rights and the rights of my family are protected, which means I feel comfortable going out around this country and speaking to others, because I know if something happens at home and someone here picks up the phone, dials 911, and a deputy shows up, they've been trained that their first duty is to protect the rights of everybody involved.
Paul, I think you're so right in getting involved on that local level. After the break, I want to share some thoughts from a broadcaster in the country who really opened my eyes to why getting involved on the local level matters. But before we do that, we got to get to a word from our sponsors. You're listening to America Emboldened with Greg Bolden on the America Out Loud Network with our special guest, Paul Engel.
It's summertime. Ready for your vacation to the beach, the lake, or the mountains? But what about your accommodations? Ever wonder what germs were left behind by the previous guests? Kathy G. from Tulsa says the Genesis Fogger gives her peace of mind and confidence when traveling. With Genesis, she knows that the air and surfaces in her vacation rental are free of bacteria and viruses left behind by the previous occupants. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud to receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you'll be ready for what's next.
You wouldn't go a day without brushing your teeth or washing your hands. What about washing your nose? I mean, your nose does filter the air you breathe, air loaded with bacteria, viruses, and irritants. Make nasal hygiene part of your routine with Clear. No messy bottles to fill, no drowning sensation. Clear is a natural drug-free saline with the added benefit of xylitol, which blocks bacterial and viral adhesion. Available in stores and online at clear.com. That is X-L-E-A-R.com.
There's a local broadcaster that I'm good friends with, Rick Jensen. He's been in radio for years. He's known as like the top 100 conservative voices in the United States. And he had told me recently in a conversation, he said, you know what, Greg, you don't have to worry about the Constitution as much as you have to worry about the regulations. He said, if you pay attention to the regulations on a local level, what's happening within your county, what's happening within your school districts, he said, that's where everything that's actually affecting your life begins. And so I see a parallel from what you just stated, Paul, of you need to worry about what's happening home before you worry about what's happening in Washington, D.C. And what a great thing to make sure that we tell people that, sure that people are aware of it.
You know, a perfect example, when Biden was going to, remember, he was going to send around door knockers to make sure you got vaccinated. And I called up my sheriff and says, hey, if a group of wackos show up on my door and they won't leave before I could finish the sentence, give us a call, we'll arrest them. That's what I want. So I'm not worried about what the people in Nashville think or the people in Washington. If you send people to trespass on my property and violate the law, I want my sheriff and their deputies to come deal with, to help me come deal with that. He also was asked at a public meeting if a mask mandate was passed, would he enforce it? And he laughingly said, no. Just think of the freedom that makes to breathe, to say, I don't have to worry about what the yahoos in Washington are doing. This guy's got my back. Now, the flip side of that is that means we have to have his back. We have to support our sheriffs when they are doing the right thing. I told him, I says, what do you need? You want me to do a class for your deputies? I'll do it for free. You want a position paper, a press release. You want someone to testify in front of a committee. If you protect my rights, I will stand with you as you do so. When the people start doing that, that's when we make differences, not just in our own lives, but we give permission for other people that may think the way we do, but they're afraid to stand alone. You give them permission to join a group and have the safety in numbers.
Not sure if you heard the story, but here in Delaware, where I reside and podcast from, there were two Delaware ATF agents and a Delaware state trooper that showed up at somebody's house last week without a warrant to demand that they saw his guns that he purchased to make sure they weren't straw purchases. And the gentleman said, I'm not grabbing my guns. You have no right to be here. You have no warrant. That's the type of local stuff. When it starts happening, you really need to take note. You really need to start paying attention when warrantless searches happen, violating your rights. And the fact that they even know that the gun should be at that home raises so many other questions. In all of this, Paul, to bring the conversation kind of to a close, I'm curious, what is more feasible? Allowing states to secede and to start supporting secession of the United States, where people can move to places where they feel more represented, or violence and fighting to get back against an ideology. It seems like, you know, both are met with the same type of taboo conversation, but it seems like that's where we're at.
I think both of them represent a failure in this experiment in self-government. And I believe it's a false dichotomy. You do not need to secede in order to remain a sovereign state. The federal government is given limited enumerated powers. When I was researching my book, I found a website that listed all the federal agencies and departments. There are hundreds of them. Even after I weeded out like the duplicates and stuff like that, there were over 450 individual. So I went through each and every one of them looking for the power delegated to the federal government, delegated to the United States by the Constitution, that they could possibly be enacting. And I mean, I was as generous as possible. I even looked at it and said, well, the Department of the Interior, the federal government does own land, much of it unconstitutional, but they would have, if they wanted to have a department that dealt with that federal, right? I literally went to that. 90% of those agencies are not exercising a power delegated to the United States by the Constitution, which means, according to the 10th Amendment, it is illegal for the United States to actually exercise that. With taking it a step farther, according to that the Article 6, Clause 2, Alexander Hamilton and Federalist Paper 78, and the Supreme Court in Marbury versus Madison, the legislative acts that created those agencies are invalid. They are void. They are meaningless. So if you have a state, and I think right now Florida is one of the better examples, says Florida doesn't need to secede for the union. Floridians need to have hire representatives that will stand up for their rights as Florida citizens. The same way I have to do it in here in Tennessee, and you need to do it in Delaware. When the states, they don't have to leave the union. They simply need to follow what the Constitution says. Look the federal government in the eye and said, listen, we did not authorize you to do that. We did not delegate to you that power. That is not legitimate. You're not allowed to exercise it within our territory. Now, that's often referred to as nullification. It isn't truly nullification unless a majority of the states all get together and say, no, you're not allowed to do that. But for a state to say, no, you can't enforce that law within our borders. We won't use our time, our money, our resources, because that is an unconstitutional act. You can have the diversity of federalism without requiring a secession.
What I believe we should be encouraging, if I'm hearing you properly and I'm putting this together properly, and I'm just trying to put together the past 60 minutes, the best thing that we can do as citizens at this point is to organize like-minded people, start going to our local government, demanding that the Constitution be followed by the state level first, that regulations are not being imposed that violate our federal rights or our state rights, and that that group should start using whatever legal measures are necessary in order to force states to start following and the politicians to start following what needs to be done for our constitutional rights. And that is likely the most peaceful solution to trying to bring us back to a more perfect union. Is there anything you want to add to that?
I would place one step before that.
Okay.
John Jay, unimportant little founding father. I mean, all he did was help negotiate and sign the Treaty of Paris, ended the Revolutionary War. He wrote several of the Federalist Papers. He was our first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And he said every member of the state ought diligently to read and study the Constitution of his country and teach the rising generation to be free. By knowing their rights, they'll sooner perceive when they're violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. I think the first step we have to do is we, the people, each and every one of us, should read and study the Constitution. See, he implied that by reading the Constitution, we'll know what our rights are, which is really important. If you're going to go to state and local governments saying, you need to protect our rights, we need to know what they are, not what someone said they are, where they are defined legally. But he also said you'll be better prepared to both defend them and assert them. Defend them is, you know, like you said, the guy saying, you cannot come into my house, you don't have a warrant. That's defending his right. The same way going to your government and saying, you need to act constitutionally, you need to follow the supreme law of the land, that's asserting our rights. That, I think, is the prerequisite step so that what we're working with is a common set of frameworks of an understanding of what is liberty, what is freedom, what the law says, and what it means we can do. And then so that when we go to these officials and we say, Mr. Sheriff, Madam Mayor, Madam Governor, Representative, here, I'm asking, you took an oath to support this document. I know what it says. I know what it means. So I can judge whether or not you're doing that job. So when I come to you and say, excuse me, when I contact my representative and say, explain to me how you get to this being a constitutional bill you're voting on, we can have a discussion and we have a standard that we can judge it by. And he understands, listen, if you don't fulfill your oath to support this Constitution, I will find somebody else who will. I don't know many people that had that discussion with a candidate that says, very simply, that's my litmus test. Do you support did you act in a way that supports the Constitution? If not, you're not qualified for office. I will find someone else.
For those that don't know, if you're going to read the Constitution at an average reading speed, it only takes 15 minutes or less. Mm-hmm. The Constitution is not a large document that is very difficult to get through. But I would hedge my bets.
I did one other thing, because I often get the question, well, I don't have time. Or I actually took the Constitution and turned it into a 30-day devotional.
Oh, wow.
All right. So just like, I mean, a lot of people read, you know, devotionals. So 2 pages a day, about 2.5 minutes a day. And in 30 days, you've read the entire Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And it's actually one of my best sellers. People love it. A, because it gives them kind of a structured way to get through it. Makes it a little less intimidating. But it also means they're dealing with topics in bite-sized chunks rather than large bunches.
That's wonderful. For those that might have missed when I said it earlier, constitutionstudy.com. If you go to Paul's website, he actually has a store right there where you can get the books that he's written. And I see there right there, there's a devotional on the site, but you can also get merchandise. And I'm guessing you're a little bit like me, Paul. We rely on our work, our body of work, our merchandise, our teaching, our books that we write, presentations to support ourselves. So, you know, if you took some information today from Paul that you really enjoy, go support him. At the very least, I will take him up on the offer to buy this devotional because I think it sounds like a neat book. So you'll definitely see a sale after this interview because I want a copy. Paul, we could talk for a long time, and I have a feeling if you're open to it, you're going to be a semi-regular guest from time to time, because I really think you have a wealth of knowledge that America needs to hear beyond just your show. But I want to make sure that I can bring you onto my show. So if that's something you'd like to agree to, we'll do it right here in front of everybody.
Yes, I will. I'll be back. And just one other thing, I mentioned that I'm going around the country. Mm-hmm. They go to constitutionstudy.com/tour. They can see where I'm going and they can invite me to come to their location. I am still filling out dates where I will come and speak at these events. And we generally have a grand old time when we do.
And Paul, if someone's hearing your voice and they want to contact you, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Just they can go right through the website. There's a contact. There's a thing to contact Paul to ask questions. I love, by the way, people who ask questions. I'll often put them on the radio if they have stuff. So there's plenty of ways to do it right through the website.
Excellent. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that is Paul Engel. I'm not sure we solved any of the world's issues regarding the Constitution, but maybe we made you a little bit more aware of the crisis that's here. We can reflect a little bit more about the state of our country in regards to that. Maybe you heard something today that you really thought engaged you. I would love to hear it. You can reach me on Twitter at RealGregBolden, or you can email me, greg@americaembolden.com. Website coming soon. It's been a great conversation, Paul. Thank you so much for your time here on the America Out Loud Network. Appreciate it. And keep rocking on your Constitution Study podcast. We're enjoying it.
Yeah, thank you. It was fun being here. And Lord willing, the creek don't rise. I'll keep doing this Constitution thing.
Amen. Take care, Paul. Be bold, America.